Chapter 1. To be naked in a room full of intently staring strangers had become a sort of relief. Michael Delancey, vicar's son, ordained priest and rising star at Lambeth Palace, shrugged out of his dressing gown and let his mind go quiet. The drawing instructor made a few remarks about the difficulty of accurately rendering hands and feet and the need to pay attention to the smallest shadows beneath the chin, below the ankle bone, and then Michael was posed, semi-recumbent, on a chaise, one foot on the floor, one arm flung back to rest beside his head. The posture was restful, though after 20 minutes, Michael's arm began to tingle. The only sounds in the room were the soft scratch of charcoal or pencil against paper, the occasional cough, or one page being set aside so another could be begun. Berthold, a fussy old Frenchman with a meticulous eye for detail, murmured critical comments to this or that student, and time drifted along in a peaceful trickle of moments.
"And now, mes prodiges, withdraw more than the fingers and the toes,"
Monsieur Berthold said.
"We have noted before the regularities of our model's features, the nobility of the brow, the fine angle of the chin, the lovely musculature, and the perfect symmetry of the dark brows. This man is quite attractive."
Monsieur's remarks, while flattering, might have been describing a marble effigy, so dispassionate was his praise.
"Now I pose him thus."
Berthold demonstrated for Michael a sitting posture, one elbow braced on a thigh, gaze on the floor.
"The handsome face is hidden. Draw this man so that, without seeing the quality of his gaze, without knowing the set of his mouth or the angle of his nose, he conveys merriment. He is about to spring up and give a shout of joy, to laugh with great glee."
Michael, staring at his feet, scrupulously clean, second toe longer than the great toe, could not see the consternation in the room, but he could feel it in the silence that greeted Monsieur's challenge. Berthold had a whole speech about the difference between an artist and a draftsman. The draftsman rendered accurate likenesses and could make a fine living doing so. May the good God bless and keep the draftsman, and may every artist aspire to at least a draftsman's skill. The artist, though, put truth on the page, the visual truth, the emotional truth, the moral truth. All a bit high-flown when the audience was a room full of young men, many of whom were more adept at draining a bottle than drawing that same bottle sitting on a sunny windowsill. One lone stick of charcoal began scratching away. High up, farthest from the centre of the room, that would be young Mr. Henderson, who preferred the longer perspective. Slight, blonde, barely emerging from adolescence, Henderson never said much, but when he did pose a question to Monsieur, the answer came without the usual garnish of sarcasm and criticism. Henderson had talent, and didn't feel compelled to brute that about. Lord Dermot Anthony, by contrast, had sizable talent and an even bigger mouth, always in the front row, close enough that Michael could smell the sour aroma of debauchery blended with expensive shaving soap. Everybody professed to like Lord Dermot, and even Monsieur offered him the occasional encouraging remark. Lord Dermot's mamma, the Marchioness of Stanbridge, was a noted patroness of the arts, as was Dermot's auntie. As the minutes crept by, Michael mentally steeled himself for his next obligation, dinner with his sister and her doting husband. Dorcas had chosen well, and she set a fine table. Alistair Mackay, Michael's brother by marriage, was a lovely fellow with a sly sense of humour and a fondness for smooth whisky. The drudgery, though, of being polite and mannerly toward some pretty widow or spinster in training for 3 or 4 hours, the hope in the lady's eyes, the determination in Dorcas's, and the sympathy in Mackay's, a penance, the lot of it. The session came to an end, and Berthold passed Michael his robe.
"Our thanks as usual. We will see you again on Tuesday, sir."
Michael donned the dressing gown and belted it loosely, then took himself to the changing room. Clothes maketh not the man, but rather the masquerade. A priest wore sober attire, though he need not be shabby. Michael enjoyed fine clothes. Perhaps if he showed up at Dorcas's with a stain on his cravat and a smear of charcoal on his cuff. But no, dissembling for personal gain would not do. He was making his way through the Academy's grand foyer, wondering if he had time for a quick stop on Circle Lane before he was due for dinner. Just 15 minutes. Not really a visit, more of a sighting. He was too intent on his plans to watch where he was going, and thus he and Henderson collided right in the doorway.
"Beg pardon,"
Henderson muttered in his signature husky tenor.
"Entirely my fault. Do go on."
He tugged down his hat brim and gestured with a gloved hand.
"My apologies," Michael said, bowing. "I was preoccupied. After you."
Henderson bustled through the door and jogged down the steps, soon disappearing among the pedestrians thronging the walkway. Michael stood on the terrace, the chilly evening breeze wafting about him as he reviewed what he'd just learned. Henderson, who preferred to sit in the studio's most shadowed corners, who rarely spoke at all, and who never joined with the other students in the general jockeying for status, was distinguished by more than talent and eccentricity. Henderson had the unmistakable bodily endowments of a well-formed woman.
"Sorry, Mac,"
Mrs. Psyche Henderson Fremont called to her coachman.
"I couldn't get the hair right."
She vaulted into the closed carriage as a young man would, as a young lady ought to be free to do, and rapped on the roof with her walking stick. Wondrous items, walking sticks. A fashionable extension of the personality, a symbol of social status, a support in case of injury, and best of all, a weapon. The one she carried was mahogany, and had a dagger secreted in the carved lion's head. Jacob had always had impeccable taste. She settled onto the forward-facing bench and flicked open her pocket watch, a good-sized article, not some squinty little ornament intended to draw the eye to a lady's bodice. 1:30. Would not do to be late. Aunt Hazel would worry, and when Aunt worried, she became fractious. Psyche extinguished the coach lamps and drew the curtains. 20 minutes later, in the mews of a quietly elegant side street, the footman handed down a fashionable young lady.
"Walker, Mac," she said. "We'll be out front in 1/2 a twinkling.
"Aye, missus."
Psyche opened the back gate and remembered to alter her stride.
"And please walk the horses," she muttered, "not walk em, for pity's sake."
She stopped at the bird bath, which sported an island of ice floating in a small sea of meltwater. Henderson would have lifted the ice out barehanded and made life a little easier for the birds and night creatures. Psyche glanced around to ensure the evening shadows were sufficient to mask her behaviour from the neighbours, used her teeth to remove one glove and dashed the ice onto the walkway. Pulling a glove on over damp fingers was more bother than anticipated. She paused, as she always did at the back door, and slowed her breathing. Young ladies did not hurry. Young ladies were not preoccupied with some model's lavishly tousled hair. Young ladies spent afternoons shopping for the sheer pleasure of handling fine fabrics and socializing with other women. Young ladies, especially young widowed ladies, were serene, gracious, pleasant, and boring as hell.
"Also bored as hell," Psyche murmured.
She took another breath and let it out slowly.
"Mustn't curse, mustn't grumble."
The model, Mr. Smith, as all the male models were Mr. Smith, remained lounging about in her imagination, and that made dropping Henderson's habits harder. Mr. Smith had the most interesting hair, and lots of it, though his demeanour otherwise was the next thing to effete. His physical attributes, with the exception of his hair, were relentlessly perfect on a generous, masculine scale. That, Psyche suspected, had been Monsieur Berthold's point in choosing such a specimen. Did Mr. Smith have a brain in his pretty head? Did passion stir in his muscular chest? To make physical monotony interesting, even exquisitely proportioned monotony, was an artistic challenge.
"Ponder later,"
Psyche summoned a smile, as she let herself through the door.
"Now it's gloves, bonnets, and parasols for you, Mrs. Fremont."
The boot boy noticed her slipping past the pantries. She put a finger to her lips, winked, and he grinned and saluted. Kevin was such a good lad, and his ears had the most charming asymmetry, one higher than the other, like an owl. Did that asymmetry mean he could identify the source of a sound more readily? Aunt Hazel bided in her private parlour, pretending to read, while doubtless watching the time. The room was supposed to be a cosy feminine space, a private retreat, but Hazel Buckthorn stood nearly 6 feet in her slippers and preferred high ceilings, gilt-framed mirrors and full-sized sofas.
"Psyche Fremont, I thought the Corsairs had taken you up. When did you get in?"
"Some time ago, and I'm quite ready to leave. Remind me again whose table we grace this evening?"
A surreptitious glance in the pier glass confirmed that Psyche's chignon was tidy, and nothing of her underlinen showed around the bodice. Hazel rose and peered down at her.
"You know quite well with whom we dine. You are trying to distract me, and without success, I might add. Did you overspend on a new shawl or a pair of riding boots?"
Hazel brought far less means to the household than Psyche did. Aunt was nonetheless bigger, 6 years older, and she had been widowed 2 years longer than Psyche. Moreover, dear Aunt was of a managing disposition. She would have made a very competent inquisitor, but for the subtle twinkle in her green eyes.
"I was the personification of restraint," Psyche said,
"though I do believe one should order next year's winter gloves this year, and to blazes with being au courant. I arranged for 2 pair from Mrs. Patterson."
A 15-minute stop on the way to the academy. The less dishonesty, the better. Jacob had taught her that.
"What I want to know," Hazel said, picking up a reticule from the sideboard, "is why we can't have fur-lined evening gloves. Perhaps I'll order a pair and start a new rage. Fur would take some of the chill off those early spring balls. Promise you won't curse tonight, Psyche. The company will be polite."
"I rarely curse."
"But when you do, the occasion is lamentably memorable."
"When I do, the occasion warrants forceful language. When men curse, they are witty, articulate, plain-spoken and forthright. A simple apology for the slip makes the incident of no moment. A wink and an apology make it dashing. When men curse, they are usually not in the company of ladies. Dorcas Mackay is a vicar's daughter, and she's married to some dour Scotsman. We'll doubtless have recruited 2 of his elderly uncles to balance the numbers. I vow if one of them tells me he's always fancied a braw, bonny lady with red hair, I will plead a severe megrim and summon the coach on the instant.
And I will be the soul of devoted concern, so please don't consign me to finishing the evening without you."
Which had happened on more than one occasion. Aunt had met Mrs. Mackay on some committee or other, committees being the fate of widows who had any means at all. Psyche wasn't about to sacrifice hours of good light for weak tea and rummage sales that took on the complexity of grand operas, at least as Aunt described them.
"Away with us," Hazel said, sailing forth. "My braw bonny self is hungry."
The coach was waiting for them at the foot of the steps, and the journey to the Mackay residence was short.
"I keep telling myself," Hazel said as the footman knocked on the front door, "that spring is just around the corner. We're weeks away from decent weather,"
which meant weeks away from the inanity that was the social season, thank God. Psyche had to participate, lest anybody get to wondering what occupied her time, but the whole business was an enormous bother. The days grew longer in spring, the light more abundant and the world more vivid. Polite dinners were also a bother, but necessary if one wanted to be perceived as a genteel and unassuming widow. Psyche took care to dress plainly, to style her hair unremarkably, and to speak softly on such occasions. Invariably, before the soup was removed, her fingers were itching to hold a paintbrush, a stick of charcoal, even a pencil. A youngish butler admitted them, and Psyche was introduced to Mrs. Dorcas Mackay, a dark-haired lady with a brisk air entirely belied by the smiles she and Mr. Mackay shared across the parlour. Mr. Mackay, Major Mackay to be more accurate, was dark-haired, tallish, and spoke with a burr. He was not in the least dour, and he clearly chaired the committee devoted to admiration of his wife. Aunt's apparent partner for the evening was one Colonel Sir Orion Goddard, a cousin to Major Mackay. Goddard's features were slightly weathered, and a subtle pattern of scars radiated from one eye. His looks suggested an interesting history, and when he switched to speaking French, Aunt replied in the same language, with a rhapsody over chocolate drops. No Megrim tonight, alas.
"Here's our final guest," Mrs. Mackay said, striding to the dimmer recesses near the parlour door and kissing the cheek of a sable-haired man who turned out to be her brother.
Mr. Michael Delancey had brought with him an air of quiet reserve, a calm that suggested he would never rhapsodise about anything. But then a vicar's son might have had all the rhapsodies preached and prayed out of him. Psyche crossed the parlour to make her curtsy to the fellow who'd be her partner for the evening, and as he bowed over her hand, a shiver skittered over her nape. His manner was so bland, so lifeless, that for a moment Psyche doubted the evidence of her own eyes.
Mr. Delancey, a pleasure.
Mrs. Fremont, likewise, I'm sure. A chilly evening, though one hopes for in early spring.
He ran a hand through his hair while exchanging polite nods with Goddard and Mackay, and that slight disarrangement confirmed Psyche's suspicions. This staid, proper, churchly cipher regularly lolled about in the all-together for hours at a time in front of a whole class of aspiring artists. And in Mr. Delancey's case, the Almighty had apparently been as parsimonious with personality as he had been generous with masculine pulchritude. Psyche came to that conclusion, a disappointment, though a relief too, when the entire meal passed, and Mr. Delancey gave not one hint that he recognised the woman upon whose breast he'd had his hand barely 3 hours earlier.
"Your Dorcas gets high marks for tenacity as a matchmaker," Rye Goddard said, accepting a glass of exquisite cognac from his host. "But Delancey gets higher marks for indifference to his sister's efforts. Sante."
Alastair Mackay nosed his whisky, honey, apples, pears, a hint of vanilla, and lifted the glass a few inches.
Slanchava, does your Anne have an opinion on the matter of Delancey's never-ending bachelorhood?
Mackay had an opinion, one not fit for polite company. Goddard eased into a wing chair, as if the cold weather might be bothering his hip.
Anne says as long as Delancey's in good appetite, we are not to worry about him. She also says a crooked pot needs a crooked lid.
Anne was Goddard's wife, also the chef in residence, at the fancy gaming hell-come-supper club he managed, and now partly owned. She'd prevailed on Dorcas to get her husband away from the club for a night, and the colonel, ever dutiful, had heeded Dorcas's summons.
"What do we hear from our cousin in Wales?" Goddard asked,
propping a boot on a hassock.
"Raptures, hoods, panegyrics."
Mackay settled into the second wing chair.
"Marital wonderment in all its lovely forms, though subtly stated. Dylan and Lydia will manage."
A relief that, of the three male cousins, Dylan Powell had been the most determined to avoid Parson's mousetrap.
"About Delancey, he's an adult," Goddard said, holding his cognac up to the firelight. "An intelligent, well-educated, healthy, inordinately attractive man who has earned the notice of the Archbishop. Dear Michael is making himself indispensable at Lambeth Palace, the saintly heart of the Church of England. Churchmen are supposed to be reserved, and Delancey has all the makings of a very successful churchman."
Potential which impressed Mackay not at all.
"Before he was a churchman, he was Dorcas's only sibling. She feels as if Michael took up his first post in Yorkshire and 5 years later sent a ghost of himself south to resume life in London. Michael used to be a mischievous, high-spirited boy, and now he's sober to the point of unrecognisability. A handsome, mannerly automaton."
Goddard sipped his drink, looking exactly like what he was, a former soldier who'd survived many a battle and who'd had the courage to marry for love. He worked hard, he loved profoundly, and he was, at long last, happy.
"Meddling and matchmaking are but two faces of the same coin," Goddard said. "We were all once high-spirited boys, and war knocked those spirits down to earth. Life and the ladies have revived us. Maybe Yorkshire was some sort of battlefield for Delancey.
That metaphor fit Mackay's own observations. I've sent a few letters north.
Reconnaissance? Keeping in touch with our former fellow officers. We know Delancey got deeply in debt before he took holy orders, and we know he's resolved those debts.
High spirits have consequences.
Not always fair, but usually true. As a youth new to the blandishments of town, Delancey had been manipulated into amassing gambling debts, all of which had been cheerfully bought up by the same scoundrel who'd led him astray, an old and lucrative rig. The scoundrel figured in Dorcas's past as well, and he had been sent packing far, far away, though after Michael Delancey had paid every penny owed, plus considerable interest.
"Mrs. Fremont is lovely," Mackay said,
trying to put his finger on what exactly had been so off about the evening thus far.
"Dorcas has paraded all manner of women before her brother, the sweet, the churchy, the bold, the funny, even a few beauties."
"I can't see Delancey caring much about a woman's appearance. His good looks have taught him at least that lesson."
"As my great good looks have instructed me on the same point," Mackay said.
Goddard threw a pillow at Mackay's knee.
"Delancey isn't pious,"
Mackay observed, taking another sip of the water of life.
"He doesn't flourish snippets of scripture like so many fancy lace handkerchiefs that prove his churchliness. I wonder if he even has a vocation."
"Since when has a true vocation been necessary for ordination?"
Mackay fired the pillow back, careful to aim for Goddard's good hip.
"We were soldiers. We know that you don't win a war, a battle, or even a skirmish on your own. Delancey hasn't learned that lesson."
Goddard shoved the pillow behind his back.
"So ask him what's amiss. Have Dorcas ask him. Tell him he has family, and if he wants the parade of widows, beauties, and sweet young things to stop, he has to rely on that family to assist him with whatever's wrong. This is very good cognac, by the way. Chateau Fournier?"
"How should I know? Sycamore Dorning gave it to me. All I know is it's not whiskey, and my family didn't bottle it."
Chateau Fournier was hard to come by in Britain, an exquisite libation for those whose tastes ran to the grape rather than the grain.
"Can Dorning get me a case of this cognac for the club?"
Goddard asked.
"Ask him. We are discussing my brother-in-law and the dismal state of his affairs, not your wine cellars. Dorcas is concerned."
"Ergo, you are concerned, and you will worry the matter like a pensioned hound gnawing an old boot."
Mackay finished his drink and decided against another.
"Delancey is my brother by marriage. I am entitled to take an interest in his situation. We've tarried the requisite 15 minutes. Do you suppose we might rejoin the ladies?"
"Delancey has to rejoin us first. How long can one man dither in the retiring room?"
"He can't plead a megrim, so needs must. Michael has the look of a fellow who has been given a harsh sentence and has decided not to attempt escape."
Goddard's sigh spoke volumes.
"Delancey is a preacher's firstborn, following in his dear papa's footsteps. Leave it, I tell you. He probably cannot support a wife on what he's paid, and patience is the only sensible course for him at present."
"Well, damn. That argument has merit."
The solution to a puzzle that sat in plain sight, and yet had eluded Mackay's notice. Goddard shifted on his pillow.
"Even a blind hog."
"Has the eye been bothering you?"
"No, as a matter of fact."
Goddard rose and set his empty glass on the sideboard.
"The winter gloom and shorter days give me a reprieve from too much bright sunlight, and makes me wear my tinted spectacles on sunny days, and the eye has ceased to be much trouble. Let's find the ladies, and a blazes with Delancey."
The ladies, as it happened, had found Delancey as he'd been on his way to joining the gentlemen. Michael, looking quietly amused at having been ambushed, declined a cup of tea.
"I have a good walk ahead of me," he said, "and had best get started."
The statuesque Mrs. Buckthorn laid a hand on Michael's arm.
"You will come with us in the coach, sir. The air on the river is bitter, and if we're to drop the colonel at his club, we're going your direction anyway."
Mrs. Fremont maintained a silence that seemed characteristic of her. She was reserved, polite, and intelligent, but neither too serious nor too charming. The lady was also pretty in a blonde, green-eyed way, but lack of animation kept her looks from true attractiveness.
"I won't refuse a lift," Goddard said. "Might as well yield to the generosity of the ladies, Delancey. Spring is a long way off."
"That it is," he said. "I am grateful for your kindness. Dorcas, my thanks for a lovely meal."
More of the correct words were said amid proper bows and polite curtsies, and within minutes the guests had departed. Dorcas led Mackay back to the family parlour and poured herself a nip of whisky.
"Michael is worse than ever, Alistair. He's so remote, so stilted. This is the brother who dared me to smoke a cigar when I was 13 and helped me sneak a kitten into my bedroom. The fellow who joined us at dinner is a changeling. The Yorkshire fairies have stolen my real brother and left me a tailor's dummy who resembles my Michael."
Mackay offered the only encouraging words he could think of.
"Delancey seems in great good health to me. He's hale, for all that he does appear preoccupied."
Dorcas considered her drink.
"Perhaps he's afflicted with melancholia. I thought surely Mrs. Fremont would have some appeal for him. Mrs. Buckthorn described her niece as a quiet paragon, never a foot wrong, but not a bore. Mrs. Fremont esteemed her late husband, but didn't turn mourning into theatrical production, according to her aunt. The lady is not vain, and she doesn't put on airs. With a little work, she could be pretty."
Mackay helped himself to a sip of his wife's drink.
"Michael hardly looked at her."
"And she hardly looked at him. They weren't rude to each other. They were simply indifferent. Why do I feel as if that makes them even more well-suited?"
Mackay set aside the drink and wrapped his wife in a hug.
"Dorcas, please, for the sake of your brother's dignity and my nerves, give it a rest. Mrs. Fremont did not seek to attract Michael's notice, and he clearly isn't looking to find himself a lady. Leave them in peace. Goddard suggested Michael cannot afford a wife, and that notion has merit."
Dorcas snuggled closer.
"Drat it, filthy lucre. Goddard could be right. Michael isn't ever likely to be wealthy. But Mrs. Buckthorn said her niece is well fixed. Perhaps I should tell Michael that."
"Perhaps we should mind our own business. Was that Anne's recipe for the orange mousse?"
Dorcas graciously conceded to the change of topic.
"Of course, and the béarnaise sauce on the potatoes is her creation as well. Different, but our guests seem to like it."
"I ate every bite and was considering seconds when Goddard beat me past the post. Another lovely meal, and now I hope to retire with my lovely wife."
He kissed her cheek, and she obligingly reciprocated his affections. Nonetheless, through the end-of-day routine, the quick visit to the nursery and even into the bedtime courtesies, Mackay could feel that Dorcas was still distracted by her brother's situation. She did not subscribe to the myth that everybody ought to marry and the sooner the better, but she did worry for Delancey's spirits. As Mackay climbed into bed with his wife and embarked on a determined course to put all worries from Dorcas's mind, he had to admit that Dorcas had voiced a curious truth. In their very lack of interest in each other, Michael and Mrs. Fremont had suggested a sort of compatibility of spirit, two diffident peas in a pod of drab, dreary propriety. Heaven, so to speak, help them both.